Greetings, everyone. I'm Rebecca BJ Allen, and I'm with the Million Vegan Grandmothers, and we have a special guest today, Keith Akers. Welcome, Keith.
Hi, BJ. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you. Keith Akers is a writer and activist and has published four books: Embracing Limits, A Radical and Necessary Approach to the Environmental Crisis. That's his most recent book. Disciples: How Jewish Christianity Shaped Jesus and Shattered the Church. The Lost Religion of Jesus: Simple Living and Nonviolence in Early Christianity. And a vegetarian source book. He's also been published in Veg News and Vegetarian Times and many other places. In his former life, he was a computer consultant with the U.S. Department of State and Education, American Management Systems, Bell Atlantic, which is now Verizon, and others. He's been researching environmental issues since the 1970s when he attended the first rally of Earth Day. His website is Compassionate Spirit, and he's recently made an appearance in the documentary Christspiracy. I am so pleased to be able to speak with you today. How long has it been that you've been a vegetarian and vegan? Tell us how you entered in this fashion.
Well, you want the short story or the long story? The short story is I read Animal Liberation about 1978, and that convinced me to go vegetarian. And I read a couple of sentences of the chapter on factory farming. I said, "That's it. I'm going vegetarian." And because I could see that he was describing about how dairy cows were treated as well, I said, "Probably I should go vegan, but first I'm going to go vegetarian, and then once I got that figured out, I can try veganism." And then about 2.5 years later, I did go vegan. And that was in 1980. So it's been a long time, and I've seen a lot of things change in the movement. I've seen a lot of great increase in the number of vegans and vegetarians. We've gone from the point of view where we wouldn't even want to be cautious about saying vegan at all, or even vegetarian, and we would make jokes about using the V word. You don't want to use the V word, and those at the beginning that meant even vegetarian, but now it's like it's everywhere.
Right, it is everywhere, and yet still people are sometimes cautious, especially say, for instance, I've heard in India, where we have people new to it, right? New and not new, because there have been vegans there for centuries also. And I wonder about the word vegetarian and veganism. I'll just bring it right up in this book about Jesus, right? And
yes,
the early Judeo-Christians or Jewish Christians.
Yes.
And why there sometimes you use vegetarian and sometimes vegan? And then I was reading that you had said that somebody said that James wouldn't even wear wool. And so that kind of feels like vegan to me. So maybe you'd like to talk a little bit about that, that early Christianity. We'll just start in there just a bit.
Sure. The difficulty revolves partially around our definition of veganism and partially around our knowledge of the early sources and so forth. The concept of veganism doesn't really exist. The word doesn't exist really before 1944, and the concept doesn't really exist before the 19th century. It's you can find people that are sort of saying, well, this and that about dairy. You can say, well, they were probably vegan or something like that. But it's really hard to parse out what they're talking about. And part of the reason revolves around the idea of use of an animal. A vegan is someone who, as far as practical and possible, doesn't use or exploit animals in any way. And what did that mean in the ancient world? Well, a lot of transportation and agriculture in the ancient world relied on animals. And how are you going to do that? How are you going to get from, from Palestine to Antioch or wherever without an animal. You could do it. You'd have to walk a lot, but I don't think that people had that concept at that time. The idea of kindness to animals existed, but I don't think the idea of not using them existed. It wasn't actually until the invention of the automobile and the railroad that people started thinking, oh, well, we don't have to use animals at all. And in fact, I've forgotten his name, but there was an early animal rights activist in the 19th century who, once he realized that he could get anywhere in England using the train, he said, well, now I don't have to use a horse. And this was sort of a breakthrough. And we sort of take that sort of mechanical backdrop for granted in modern society, but in ancient society, it wasn't quite as clear. So that's the main reason. But I think that the early Christians were certainly had a plant-based diet, and it's pretty much all plants. Dairy and eggs actually were fairly uncommon in the ancient world, because in the ancient world, dairy, it couldn't really be a commercial venture, because to make it a commercial venture, you'd have to ship it somewhere, even if it was just like a day away. Milk doesn't really keep that well. Whereas for an animal, the animal sort of provides its own transportation. You can just drive the animal to wherever you want it and then kill it there. You don't have to think about preserving the meat or anything like that.
I
So it's storage isn't that much of an issue.
I
So meat, very rare in the ancient world. The 1% in ancient society are those who could go into the meat market and think about buying meat, other than on very special occasions. And I talk about that in both of my books on the history of early Christianity.
see. So, seeing an animal being hurt. James didn't want the animal hurt, for example. We don't know this, but so he would not eat wool because it's hurting an animal. So that makes me think of the whole basic golden rule of not harming others. And like all of our children and grandchildren, my students and nieces, nobody wants to harm an animal, but if they don't see it,
Yes,
it's a different
exactly.
thing. And so, how did you move from this early study of Christianity? For instance, you have so many resources. You've been studying it for years, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
And
pretty
then
much.
into embracing limits. You moved into the environmental section, or maybe you have been doing that concurrently. How did that happen?
Well, actually, I've been doing environmental research all along. As you recall, my first book, A Vegetarian Source Book, I had a third of the book devoted to environmental issues, the section on vegetarian ecology. And I talked about many of the same things that I do in Embracing Limits, soil erosion, groundwater depletion, and so forth. All these kinds of issues come out in a vegetarian source book. So I was aware of them for a long time and was even doing some research on it. And I got into the, it's actually, you could ask, well, how I got into the Christianity aspect, but I saw that this was an area which was not well researched in either the scholarly literature or the popular vegetarian vegan literature either. And so I said, well, this would be easy. I could do that. So I wrote Lost Religion of Jesus and then went on to write Disciples as well. So it's, I think all of my work, I'm a little bit eclectic. I tend to move into areas that other people don't touch. If they In the 1980s, nobody was talking about the environment in vegetarian vegan circles. They would say, oh, well, it takes a lot of land, and they would sort of let it to do, it takes a lot of land to do livestock agriculture, and they would sort of let it drop there. But anything further not was wasn't really discussed very much. So I was attracted to that and Christianity, because Christianity wasn't really researched. And when I first started looking at Christianity, which was actually still while I was doing a vegetarian source book, my initial take was that Christianity was anti-vegetarian. And I found a lot of the passages in Paul where he says, eat anything sold in the meat market without raising questions of conscience. And I tended to sort of paint the whole movement in those terms. But then when I got into the history of early Christianity, I saw that it was much more complex than that, and that Paul indeed had opponents. And his opponents were vegetarian. And in fact, his opponents were probably the leaders of the early church. And so that leads us to believe the question, the whole concept that Jesus went along with all the stuff about eating meat. And in fact, I think he did not. I think he was totally plant-based and, you know, and intended, and the movement was intended to be that way from the beginning. If you look at the Jewish Christian literature and the recognitions and the homilies, sources like that, you can see that one of the main things they're against is they're against animal sacrifice. It comes up constantly, the bloody animal sacrifices, we reject those, and so forth and so on. So I think that I think the case for Jesus being vegetarian or vegan, depending on your definition of veganism, is very strong. I think it's very strong. And the whole, in fact, the entire movement, the entire movement, the early Christian movement, got disrupted in a major way after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem after the year 70. So after this, the whole movement changes. And that's what I wanted to look at. And so you have to be careful to look at the early sources to find out what the movement really was like.
That is so fascinating. In my whole life of being brought up, first in the Baptist Church and then the Unitarian Church, well, Methodist Church was in there too as a youngster. I don't remember hearing anything about Jesus and not eating animals, but it was certainly kind to animals because, you know, a representation of the kindest person in the world. And so as a child, it would make sense that if he's a kind person, he wouldn't want to harm animals as well as people. But I don't remember hearing that preached even recently. Yeah, very interesting.
Yes.
And also, you talk about simple living in that book about the lost religion of Jesus. And in your book on embracing limits, you talk about, there's so many incredible things in this book. I'm only the partway through, but driving through Austin the other day, we saw so much new buildings. And my friends were saying, gosh, there's so much building going on. And it reminded me of the degrowth chapter that you have. Yes. And how are we going to degrow our society, live simply, and you've written about it. What would you like to say to us about that?
Well, the thing we have to understand about climate and all the other environmental issues that we face is that it's bigger than just climate change. Climate is an important part about it, a part of it, and we certainly should be thinking seriously about climate. The situation now seems to be almost completely out of control. All the scientists are tearing their hairs out and say, look at this data. And everybody's going, well, whatever. And so it's a serious problem, no doubt about it, but it's a bigger problem than just climate. We can't really deal with climate without dealing with the whole problem of our economy expanding beyond sustainable limits. Because we're not just unsustainable in terms of climate, we're unsustainable in many other ways as well. We're unsustainable in terms of our relationship with soil and water, and in relationship with just the metals that we're extracting from the earth and all the plastic that we're making. I found an interesting piece of data that said that a study that reported that the total mass of all man-made artifacts from, you know, roads, buildings, junk, plastic in the ocean, whatever, all of this now outweighs all living things on Earth.
Oh,
it's my actually, goodness. There's more of it than there is not only of us, but of all plant matter, all bacteria, animals, everything, including humans.
on the planet. And people just don't understand the scale of what we've done and how the planet has become so homogenized to be composed basically of, well, us. It's us and our livestock. That's about it. If you look out on the landscape in terms of large animals, that's it. So I think the people have to realize that there's going to be a lot more involved than just going to renewable energy, which is going to be a major task in itself. Going into renewable energy and building lots of wind turbines and solar panels and things like that. Not a bad idea, but it's not enough. It's not nearly enough that we're going to run out of lots of other things, not literally run out, but we will get to the point where it'll become harder and harder to acquire oil. It'll be harder and harder to acquire all the metals and minerals, which depend on this intensive use of energy, and to transport it all across the globe. So we have to rethink our whole society, and that's sort of where I get back into the simple living and Christianity. Christianity's not unique here by any means, at least early Christianity before it got distorted, is not unique in recommending this kind of simple living. But that's the kind of world we need to be thinking about. We need to be not just constantly expanding, growing, building. It can't go on forever. And in fact, we've probably overshot our sustainable boundaries quite a bit already. We have to actually shrink the economy. Agriculture is probably one of the key ways that we can shrink the economy because, as we all know, livestock is extremely inefficient in terms of resource use.
Right. And so individually, we can continue to, for all of us here, eat plant-based, and for others to move more to a plant-based diet, and then gradually become more aware of the wool and all of those kinds of vegan things. But in your book, you have, there's so many things. There's soil and
Yes.
yeah, and oil, and so many things.
Soil and oil, yes.
Soil and oil. So, our awareness is one thing. In terms of our actions, I think maybe it comes down to not buying so much. And I think you talked about if we try to envision ourselves with so many electrical appliances. I mean, how many can we keep? Shall we keep buying electrical appliances? And where can we individually? And then, of course, your book is also about collectively. What do you think about us individually?
Well, the thing is, I wouldn't beat, we can't beat ourselves up too much about not living environmentally because it's dependent upon our society. Our society is such that in the United States today, you're either a consumer or you're homeless. It's like there's no in between. It's not like in the 19th century when Walden could. And Walden with Thoreau could just go to the edge of the city and grow beans. You can't go to the edge of the city and grow beans these days. You can't even find the edge of the city. And if you did find the edge of the city, you'd find another suburb and it would go on. And you just couldn't do it. Our society has developed to the point where it's very difficult to truly live simply. We can do some things, but there are other things that we can't do. And one of the examples I talk about in my book is an example of a bicycle. A bicycle is the most efficient form of transportation that humans have. You can't use it all the time, but when you can use it, it's like you can go from point A to point B much more efficiently than any other means of transportation. In fact, it's even more efficient than walking. It's even more efficient than walking. And it's also the most efficient form of transportation in nature. So, in terms of a cougar getting from point A to point B and saying how fast it moves, how much it weighs, and so forth, that in terms of a bicycle can convey the same amount of weight, the same distance, maybe not as fast, but it can do it the same distance much more efficiently than anything in nature or that we've devised so far. So you say, oh, let's ride bicycles. Well, let's ride bicycles. Okay. Have you been out on the street lately in highway traffic trying to ride a bicycle? It's dangerous. Our society is not built for bicycles. It is built for cars because that's where the money is. That's how you're going to make money. You're not going to make a lot of money selling bicycles. You can make a few, a few dollars here and there. And there are some bicycle companies. But if you want to make the big money on transportation, you got to sell people, a car, preferably an SUV that's big and expensive. That's the way to make money. And so our society develops with highways instead of bicycle paths.
Right.
And so we have to deal with that. So, and there's different ways we can fight against that. And I think we need to draw together and think of those, what those ways are, in order to change society so that it would be possible in the first place to live more simply.
I think you're right. I think I heard an interview where you said that social justice, if we're going to have to do social justice so we don't leave people behind. I mean, they're already being people left behind. Right.
Yeah. The big concern that people have about degrowth is, wait a minute, we're broke. I can't shrink my income any further. And what about all the people that are living on $1 or $2 a day out in various parts of the world? You can't ask them to get into degrowth. This is degrowth mostly in the Western societies. I think that there are probably some countries that are less developed maybe don't have to grow at all or don't have to degrow at all. But I think that within every country in the United States and also in other foreign countries as well, you have growing massive inequality. You've got a few people have a lot of stuff, and you've got everybody else that's essentially either literally or almost out on the streets. And so it's a problem. What are you going to do about inequality? And who's doing all the carbon emissions? Who's doing all the consuming? Who's destroying the earth? It's the people who have a bunch of money. That's basically what it is. And so we need social equality. We need a movement towards social equality. And this goes hand in hand with the idea of degrowth, because one of the things that you could do is just shrink all this inequality back down. And so that the rich aren't consuming so much, and that would take care of quite a bit of the problem just right there. So I think that we have to pursue social justice and degrowth at the same time.
Right. Wow. And that makes me think of the early Christianity that you were writing about, the Ebionites. I'm not sure how to say that, but simple living and living poorly. How do you say it?
Ebionites. That no one knows. I mean, let's see. I'm not sure. The thing is, we don't even know how Latin was pronounced by the Romans, and I'm not sure how ancient Hebrew was pronounced by the ancient Jews. But we don't know. But I pronounce it Ebionites because that's the way it looks like in English when you write right out the word. But if somebody comes to says Ebionites, I'm not going to. I'm not going to make a big fuss about it.
All right. So they lived simply and,
yes.
And, right. Okay. Well, this is just fascinating. Do you have a particular limit that you want us to focus on? Or is it, like you said, be gentle with yourself, but, is it go vegan?
Well, yeah, that's for starters. Actually, one of the things points I make in my book is that of all the things we have to do in order to decrease our energy use, bring climate under control, and things like that, and reduce consumption of materials, and evolve towards some sort of sustainability, of all the things we have to do, probably veganism is actually the easiest. It's actually the easiest. You try getting converting our current energy system to a renewable economy. It would, first of all, I don't think you can really do it. I don't think you could. I think it's impossible, basically. But I think you could get closer, and you could have a reasonable standard of living on a lower consumption of energy. But it would be, even if it can be done. And some people say, oh, wait a minute, you know, we're making a lot of progress on renewables and solar panels are becoming more efficient and so forth. And they may be right. Batteries are getting cheaper. People will give you that kind of argument. They may be right, but still it's a massive undertaking. We're talking trillions of dollars. We're talking about, you know, decades of work. We're talking about huge increase in materials use, at least temporarily, while we get all the renewable system set up. So it's a massive undertaking. It will require, essentially, it will require what we would call sacrifices. It will require sacrifices of the American people. And people do not have a glimmer of this. People do not understand that this is what we're talking about. And nobody wants to talk about it either, because the renewable proponents don't want to say, well, this is going to cost a lot of money, so get ready for a big bill. Then people are going to say, well, forget it. So they don't want to confront the issue. But the need for energy reform, I would say, don't want to confront it either, because they know that climate is a big deal and that people are concerned about it. So everybody just sort of sits there and says, well, maybe we should consume more sustainably, and they sort of let it go at that. But if we want to look at the nitty gritty, we'll see that actually veganism is one of the easier. We already have the technology to grow plants. We've been doing it for thousands of years. So it's not like this is something new that we have to come up with. I think that's the direction we ought to go in. We ought to think about and come to grips with this in terms of society. The whole society has to come to the grips with the fact that there are limits to growth. There's no two ways about it. It doesn't matter who gets elected. Doesn't matter. Trump can't change it. Biden can't change it. Nobody can change it. It's simply physics. And so our society will change. It will change massively. We don't know how rapid it will be. We don't know exactly where we're going. We know that the social situation is very chaotic. But since that's the framework that we need to be thinking in terms of, and when you put it that way, veganism looks like, well, we could do that with no problem.
Wow, that's wonderful. That makes sense. I had heard about a survey where people said, would you rather give up meat or give up your car? And they all chose to give up the meat rather than the car. But when you look at all of the things that you've just talked about, it's wonderful. That's great. Great to know. Yes. There's something simple we can do.
Well, yes. So I would say we need to find other people that understand this problem. The people who understand the whole problem of limits to growth, it's like maybe 1 in 1,000 people might understand this. The numbers are growing, but it's still very small. And there's all different, the opinions among the degrowth community are all over the map. Some people say, well, we need to do this or we need to do that. And they're wildly different. We need to get together. We need to figure it out. And then we need to convince, first of all, convince the vegans and the animal rights people that we need a big social change. And then we need to convince the environmental movement. And then we need to take that to the general population.
Yes. Wow. So education.
Education for now. Yes, you can certainly change yourself. Certainly, you should go vegan. Certainly, you should change yourself in other ways. Ride a bicycle that's not too dangerous, et cetera, et cetera. But the important thing, I think, is to live as simply as you can and to draw together so that we can think about how we can accomplish this sort of massive social change, which is going to come, but we don't know exactly when or how.
Wow. Thank you so much, Keith. This has been so wonderful. And our children, our grandchildren, and the grandchildren of all the species need to move forward with this understanding so we can make some progress here and still have an Earth. Would you like to say any final words?
Well, I'm going to be at VCOP17, and my name is Keith Akers, and I'm going to talk about all of this stuff, and I hope to see you there.
Thank you so much, Keith. That was fabulous. That was fabulous.